Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi, and a very good morning to you. This is Rabbi Michael Katz here with you. It is Judaism 101.9. It is just 11:09. It's sort of all synchronistic. 11:09 on the clock here in the studio, and it is 11 o'clock, and or just gone 11 o'clock rather. And it today is the second day in the month of Adar. We're in this month of Adar, and we said last week we spoke about the fact that Mishinichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. This is the month of joy. Now, joy doesn't just happen in isolation. Sometimes joy, simcha, happens after something negative, after something sad has happened. And the resultant joy of the being released, or of the fact that there has been a homecoming, or the fact that now we can finally get up from our sadness, elicits joy. And so simcha, in terms of this month of Adar, is not just in isolation. The simcha of Adar, really, when we focus on the essence of it, comes later on in the month with the story of Purim. Remember, there was the most terrible, terrible decree against the Jewish people, and the fact that that was overturned, and the fact that the destruction of the Jewish people with Haman and Ahasuerus and his ilk had the ability to carry on, or to carry out rather, to destroy the entire Jewish people wherever they were in every single known state at the time, the joy at that being overturned. So yeah, there was the hardship, there was the difficulty, but the simcha that ensues is something that is absolutely incredible. So in our look back at history, which we always start off with on Judaism 101.9, to see kind of the atmosphere of these days, when we go to the second of Adar, we have a very sad occurrence, something tragic that happened in 1960, not all that long ago, in Morocco. On this day, hundreds of Jews, including some students of the local yeshiva, were among the thousands of victims who perished in a devastating earthquake that struck Agadir in Morocco. And that happened on the 2nd of Adar in 1960. So, sad, tragic occasion. But if we go to tomorrow, the 3rd of Adar, we have the Second Temple being completed. Now, this happened in 349 before the Common Era, so we're going back over 2,000 years ago. Of course, the Second Temple, the Second Beit HaMikdash, 349 before the Common Era, the joyous dedication of the Holy Second Temple on the site of where the First Temple had stood in Yerushalayim was celebrated actually on the 3rd of Adar in the year 3412, or as we said, 349 before the Common Era, after 4 years of work. The first temple, which was built by King Solomon, was destroyed by the Babylonians in 423 before the Common Era. And at that time, the prophet Yirmiyahu prophesied, "Thus says God, after 70 years for Babylon will I visit you and return you to this place." Yes, prophet Yirmiyahu says that. And in 371, the Persian emperor Cyrus permitted the Jews to return to Judah and rebuild the temple. But the construction was halted the next year when the Sumerians persuaded Cyrus to withdraw this permission. Ahasuerus of Purim fame upheld the moratorium, and only in 353, exactly 70 years after the destruction, did the building of the Second Temple resume under Darius. Isn't that amazing that this is prophesied, and it worked out to be almost exactly the time, and of course relevant to our Purim story. Second Temple was completed in 349 before the Common Era, and on which day? That's actually celebrated tomorrow, the 3rd of Adar. Now we go back to another sad one. The Maharam, the famous Maharam, his body was ransomed in 1307. That's of the Common Era, of course, 1307, going back close on, 900 years ago. 800 years ago, the tragic saga of the imprisonment of Reb Meir ben Baruch, who was known as the Maharam of Rottenburg, came to a close when his body was ransomed 14 years after his death, and the ransom was sorted out by Alexander ben Shlomo. The Maharam was a leading Torah authority in Germany. He authored thousands of halakhic halachic responsa, as well as the Tosafos commentary on the Talmudic tractate Yuma. In 1283, he was imprisoned in the Eisenheim fortress and held for a huge ransom. But here, interestingly, this was the Maharam who forbade the Jewish community to pay it. He would not allow the Jewish community to pay a ransom based on the Talmudic ruling that exorbitant sums should not be paid to free captives, as this would encourage the taking of hostages for ransom. We were dealing with hostages and ransoms and high exorbitant sums even in those days. So we're going back here to 1215, 1290, somewhere around there, that we're talking about this incredible story of the capture of the Maharam, his being held. And for many years, the Maharam's disciple, Rav Shimon ben Tzadok, was allowed to visit him in his cell and recorded his teaching in a work called Tashbetz. So imagine this great sage, this great rabbi being held in a prison, his student visiting him, writing down whatever he taught him, but the Maharam would not allow the ransom to be to be paid. And even after the Maharam's passing, and he passed away in 1293, his body was not released for burial until it was ransomed by Reb Alexander, who was subsequently buried at the side of the Maharam. And a fascinating story. You kind of can't believe that these things actually happened. Here's another fascinating one in 1798. So fast forward to 1798, something happened on the 4th of Adar. Because in 1555, Pope Paul, now remember, we're going back to a time of papal rulership, and Pope Paul the IV segregated the Jews of Rome in a walled quarter surrounded by gates that was locked at night. By the way, this is where the word ghetto comes from. The ghetto Jews were then subjected to various forms of degradation and restrictions on their personal freedoms. So this under papal rulership. Now, during the French Revolution, Italy was conquered by Napoleon. Napoleon Bonaparte conquers Italy. And on the 4th of Adar, which was a Tuesday, the 20th of February, 1798, the ghetto was legally abolished. It was reinstated, however, as soon as the papacy regained control. So we think about it. The popes making sure that the Jews remained in ghettos. Napoleon Bonaparte was part of, nice play on words there, part of the release of the Jews from the ghetto, but they were returned there as soon as the popes came back into play. And, of course, a big blot on the legacy of papal rulership, papal dynasties, etc. Now, if we also then go forward to Monday, the 6th of Adar, it's on this day, the 6th of Adar, that Moshe Rabbeinu completed the Torah. Now, this was in 1273, before the Common Era. Moses completed the book of Deuteronomy of Dvarim, concluding his review of the Torah, which he began several weeks earlier on the 1st of Shvat. He then wrote down the completed five books of Moses, word for word, as dictated to him by God. The scroll of the Torah was put into the Holy Ark next to the tablets of testimony. It also marks the day of the first print of Torah with Unculus and Rashi in 1482. Here, the first edition of the five books of Moses, what we know as the Chumash, with Targum Unculus, which is an Aramaic translation of the Torah, and the commentary of the famed commentator Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who was known as Rashi. Today we just pick up a Chumash and we have there the Unculus and the Rashi. It was first published on this date in 1482 in Bologna, Italy, by Yosef ben Avrom Karavita, who set up a printing press in his own home. It's quite an amazing story there as well.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Welcome back. Rabbi Michael Katz here with you. This is Judaism 101.9, coming to you live from the Chai FM studio here in Johannesburg. It is wonderful to be with you. It's wonderful to be in your company. And beautiful time of Adar that we are in now. One of the most interesting dates of Adar, actually, aside, of course, from Purim and so on, is the 7th of Adar. 7th of Adar will be coming up on this coming Tuesday, and on that day we commemorate the birthday and the passing of Moshe Rabbeinu Moses. He was born in 1393 and lived until 1273 before the Common Era. 120 years old exactly to the day was the age of Moshe Rabbeinu of Moses when he passed on. Now remember that in the story of Purim, Haman was all excited about the fact that he had picked on a month through the lottery, the Purim that he drew, the lots that he drew, he had picked on the date of or the month of Adar in which the Jewish people would be killed, would be destroyed. And he said, ah, you see, God has got it in for them as well. And the lottery was drawn especially to commemorate or to link with the death of Moshe. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moses, the greatest leader of the Jewish people who led us out of Egypt, that he passed away in that month. Of course, it's a sad time for the Jewish people. Unbeknownst to him, or perhaps without thinking it through a little bit deeper, it's also Moshe Rabbeinu's birthday. And if we think about it as Jews, we always think about the passing of somebody, not in the same terms, I guess, as the whole world does. It's not an end. The neshama, the soul, continues to live. And we celebrate the fact that this person was born in the first place. We celebrate Moshe Rabbeinu and everything that he contributed and that he gave, and his Torah and so on, and everything that that he taught throughout his lifetime. It is as though he is still alive. The fact that his body left us, the fact that there was no longer that physical presence while the soul is now elevated in a different realm and so on. But Moshe Rabbeinu lives on in our daily lives. He's with us all the time. In fact, after the passing of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, their neshama continues and can be everywhere at the same time. Something absolutely incredible, no longer limited, so to speak, by the bodily presence, by the bodily limitation. And so Moses was born, of course, in Egypt on the 7th of Adar in 2368 from creation. It was 1393 before the Common Era, and he passed away on his 120th birthday on Zayin Adar, on the 7th of Adar. And as we said before, the idea of simcha is not just only open-ended simcha that really comes from nowhere, but very often it's got a little bit of the pain attached to it, and that is what promotes, what makes that simcha even greater. And of course, all the ideas and all the things that we shared in the build-up to this, of course, was something quite incredible about the month of Adar and the Simcha that we celebrate. Now, we've got to also know that the 7th of Adar was actually the date on which the Spanish Inquisition really began in earnest. The Spanish Inquisition in 1481, it was created actually a lot earlier to find Christian heretics who would be punished or killed. And eventually, Jews were open to such charges of heresy simply for being Jewish. Torture was extracted in confessions. And over the years, the Inquisition, which operated with papal consent, we've got to remember, it spread to many countries. And in 1481, it began in earnest in Spain, where the Jews who were known as secret Jews, or Anusim, or Moranos, actually were weeded out. It was much more anti-Jewish in Spain than anywhere else. And the first public sentencing and burning alive of 6 Jewish men and 1 woman by the Spanish Inquisition was held on this date, on the 7th of Adar, which is going to be Tuesday, in Seville, in southern Spain. And following the start of the Spanish Inquisition, of course, many people fled Spain, including Christopher Columbus, who founded America. And so on the back of the destruction and the anti-Semitism and the terrible things of the Spanish Inquisition, it gave birth to the rise of a whole new frontier, of a whole new world, of America, founded probably because of the Spanish Inquisition. Terrible, heinous, horrific. And we think about all these papal decrees and all the things that came from these Christocentric countries, unfortunately, were really, really damaging, really, really dastardly in the way that they went about burning Jews at the stake, making sure that Judaism did not exist in their realm and in their areas, and so on. The Homans of the time were dressed up in their garb at that time, and the celebration of when that all ended, when that all stopped, of course, brings about the reason why there is so much cause to be joyous, to be happy, as we need to do on a regular basis, and particularly in this month of Adar. Sometimes on Judaism 101.9, we take a little moment to think about a theme within Judaism or something that perhaps we can unpack together and think about a general idea that perhaps has a lot more bearing on our daily activities than one would perhaps ordinarily think about. Just this morning, we were hearing reports even on this radio station about water and water source shortages and so on. Now, water actually plays a huge part in Jewish ritual functioning, the washing of hands, the washing in general. You know, at times gone by when there were claims that Jews were not as for instance, when it came to certain of the plagues, and especially the Black Death, as it was known, there was a whole question that was raised as to why Jewish children didn't die as much as the non-Jewish children did. And it turned out after some great research that in fact it was attributed to the fact that Jews wash their hands more regularly. The idea of washing was not, however, only instituted within Judaism and within Jewish practice and within Torah liturgy for cleanliness, but it had a significance of great preparation. You know, we wash our hands to prepare for something. It's a symbol of preparing, making sure that our hands spiritually are clean for the day, or spiritually clean for the meal, or spiritually clean for our contact with things that were going to be in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. So if we think about it, there are so many times when hand washing takes place. Number one, we wash our hands upon awakening in the morning. As soon as we wake up in the morning, we say the Modeh Ani, that's even before you wash your hands. And you then wash your hands, the Tilat Yadayim. It's also known as Negelwasser, or in Yiddish, nail water, Negelwasser, right? This water, either on a basin or a bucket or whatever, a container next to your bed or close by, that you shouldn't have to walk away from the bed in order to utilize it, is important. The Zohar teaches that you shouldn't walk more than 4 cubits without washing your hands. 4 cubits means really 4 steps. And before this washing, you avoid touching your mouth, your eyes, your nose, your ears, or any bodily opening, as well as food or drink or clothing. Since most people don't have a sink within 4 cubits of their bed, you should prepare a cup of water in a basin near your bed before you go to sleep at night to follow this injunction of the Zohar. After washing the Tilat Yadayim in the morning, we don't say the blessing right away. We first rinse our mouth, take care of our bodily needs, the bathroom, etc. And once we have done that, we wash our hands again, and only then say the bracha once we have gone out of bathroom area. We do not make blessings in a bathroom at all. We don't mention God's name there at all. If you were up all night, you should still wash until at Yadayim after daybreak, even if you were careful. For instance, you wore gloves, etc., you would still need to wash your hands. And if you woke up before dawn, you should wash upon waking. So how do we do it? How do we wash our hands? We use a cup. Now, you often see that people use cups. We've got to be careful that there's a cup that has got a round edge. The lip, the edge of the cup should be completely round. It shouldn't have a spout. If there's no cup available, you can wash without a vessel. However, we have a disagreement amongst our sages whether you can make a bracha over that kind of washing. We lift the cup with our right hand. We then pass it to the left before pouring. We wash the right hand first and then the left, alternating hands for a total of 3 washings each. So we go right, left, right, left, right, left, until we've done it three times on each hand. If you're a left-handed person, you lift the cup with your right hand, you wash your left hand first, and the water must reach between the fingers. So the way to position your hand is to move it around a little bit while you're washing so that the water actually touches all sides. You know, if you were to wash your hands and just pour water on the top of the hand, the bottom of it would stay dry. So we need to make sure that we move the hand so that the water flows on both the top and the bottom of the hand, so to speak, the inside and the outside of the hand, as well as between the fingers. We should ideally wash up to our wrists. However, if water is limited, which sometimes happens in this country, we should at least wash our fingers up to the join of the finger to the hand where your knuckles are. The bracha that is made on washing is Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kidshanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu. We say, blessed is God who has commanded us. Remember, this is a command, it's a mitzvah. Al Netilat Yadayim, on the washing of the hands. So what happens if you don't have water? What happens if you're living in this time and this period where actually there's no water available? You wake up. You should not delay learning Torah or reciting blessings. Instead, you clean your hands with whatever is available. You can use a cloth or a rock or similar, and you may then learn Torah and say brachas. So you kind of rub your hands on a rock, rub your hands on a wall, or wipe it with a cloth. But you should still avoid touching food and drink as far as possible or anything like that until you have the opportunity to properly wash your hands at a later stage, perhaps in the day. If a small amount of water is available, you should wash your hands as best as you can, as we said before. Now, that is one time of washing early in the morning. We also wash our hands before prayer. Now, this is in addition to washing when we wake up in the morning. Before davening, you're obligated to wash your hands at least up to the end of your fingers. And strictly speaking, washing once directly from a sink is enough. Some people have the custom to wash each hand three times like in a with a vessel, like in the morning. Either way, you do not make a bracha there. So the blessing is only said on the first washing after you come out of the bathroom in the morning. That is when you make a bracha. Now, you will have noticed that Kohanim, who do Birkat Kohanim on the festivals in this country or every day in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, Kohanim bless the congregation through the blessing called Birkat Kohanim, which is the threefold blessing that the Kohanim say. Their hands must be washed in a similar way to the washing done for bread. No blessing is recited, and the Kohanim have their hands washed by the Levim. And in many communities, it is the custom that the Levim, the Levies, wash their hands, their own hands first, and then they will wash the hands of the Kohanim. No bracha made, but it's done in a similar way to the washing for bread. So how do we wash for bread? Before eating bread, we need to wash our hands using a washing cup or a similar utensil. And here, instead of washing alternatively, one on each hand, right, left, we wash three times, or at least two times, but making sure that we wet the entire hand. Depends on different customs. We do this consecutively, and we recite the blessing on the Netilat Yadayim. And this is before we eat bread. In other words, before we commence a meal. Another time for washing the hands, of course, is when we have gone to the bathroom. So during the day, so you've eaten, you've done, well, now you go to the bathroom. Strictly speaking, you don't need to wash your hands with a full amount or procedure used for Netilat Yadayim. However, many people are careful to wash three times. So if you put your hands under a tap, you rinse off your hands or whatever, most would say that that is sufficient when you've just been to the bathroom, especially when you haven't really done that much in the bathroom. For instance, you have not actually done all your bodily functions, let's say it. You do not have to wash Netilat Yadayim in the same way, but we do make sure that we rinse off our hands. Now, there you go. After bathroom activity, the idea of washing hands has a great hygienic purpose as well, but this is much more ritual, spiritual. Remember, during the day, we understand, we believe that everything that we're going to touch, everything that we're going to do should have a godly purpose. We're actually a little operators of godliness in this world, and every mitzvah and everything that we do, we should be properly spiritually prepared for. And so therefore the washing of hands is something that is done to cleanse, to make sure that my hands are clean to do the spiritual things that I'm going to do, whether it is, so we often think, well, you know what, all I'm doing is I'm doing paperwork, I'm in the office. No, your purpose of being there or your purpose of doing that is for a spiritual reason. You want to put food on the table, you want to pay your kids' school fees, you want to make sure that you raise your family correctly, you want to be able to provide for your community, for your family, etc. That is ultimately why you're working in the first place. And even that can be and should be turned into a thing of kedusha, and therefore washing of hands when you come out of the bathroom.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Now, we've been speaking about on Judaism 101.9 today, we've been speaking about water and utilizing water and the washing of hands. And here I'm going to give you now some of the lesser known times of washing hands. Yes, we know. We wash our hands after the bathroom, we know. We wash our hands when we wake up in the morning, we know. We wash our hands when we eat a meal. We wash the Kohanim's hands when they go up to do the duchening, the birkat, birkat Kohanim. How about some of these? Do you know that you're supposed to wash your hands after you cut hair or nails? This would apply to the person having the haircut or the nails cut, as well as the one doing the cutting, if it should so be that those are two different people. So after cutting your hair or nails, you should wash your hands. A cup isn't required, but many people are strict about washing three times with a cup, as we would do coming out the bathroom. Additionally, the washing has to cover the entire hand, so just pouring a few drops over your hand and rubbing them together is not enough. It applies both to the person getting the haircut or doing the cutting, and that having been said, it is clear that at an optionish, where a little boy's hair is cut when he's 3 years old, those who cut just a small snip do not require to wash their hands. Do you know you've got to wash your hands if you touch your shoes? Yeah, if you touch your shoes, you need to wash your hands. But it doesn't have to be three times or with a cup. You could just rinse it off quickly under a tap. But washing of the hands should be done if you touch your shoes. And you very often see somebody's shoelaces, for instance, come undone, and they're in the middle of davening, they're in the middle of shul. They need to actually go out and wash their hands before continuing with the davening, doing all the other things of holiness that you are involved in. You also need to wash your hands, by the way, if you touch the covered parts of the body, the normally covered parts of your body. So if you scratch under your shirt, if you scratch at the top part of your arm, or you put your hand down your shirt and scratch your back, etc. And obviously for all other parts as well, you need to wash your hands once you have touched those parts of the body. It's also the instruction to wash your hands before and after intimacy. Strictly speaking, doesn't need to be through a cup, and once is even enough. Many have the custom here as well that the washing is done three times, like the washing of coming out of the bathroom. We also wash our hands, as people know, when we have attended a funeral or been at the cemetery. After leaving a cemetery or a funeral, you should wash your hands. Although, strictly speaking, washing once from a tap would be enough, the common practice is that we use a cup and we wash three times, alternating our hand washing like we would do in the morning. When we return from a funeral, one should not enter a house without having washed your hands. That, of course, is usually done at the cemetery, but in case you didn't do that, and you should always then also place the cup down, not pass it on to somebody else. They refill it. You don't, there's like trying to be gentlemanly or ladylike, you fill the cup for somebody else. No, the idea of filling the cup is something that is part of the washing, and the person themselves should wash and fill the cup. Very often, sometimes people fill the cup and they put their own finger into the cup of water, and therefore, in inverted commas, that water is already contaminated. We should make sure that we spill out whatever's left in the cup and put the cup down and let somebody else to take it. It is customary on the washing at the cemetery, if we refrain from drying the hands with a towel, we allow them rather to air dry on their own. And this, of course, is common practice. Not everybody knows that. We should not necessarily dry our hands as we leave the cemetery. Be back with you right after this.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Yes, hi and welcome back. This is Rabbi Michael Katz. This is Judaism 101.9 and it is great to be with you. We are coming towards the end of our time together today, but we've been speaking about washing the hands. Washing hands for the preparation of the day, of a meal, of work in the temple, of blessing each other. And any activity, actually, if you think about it, that requires like focus and involvement and has a kedusha, a holiness attached to it, we need to make sure that the washing of the hands is done prior to and sometimes after that activity. Now, we also know that if you sleep more than half an hour during the day, you should wash your hands three times, similar to the morning washing. No blessing is required. You don't have to make a bracha. And the stringency of not walking before washing doesn't apply to daytime sleep. So if you lay down, you had a little schlof on the couch or during the day, sometimes in your office, I guess, and you slept for more than half an hour, you should wash your hands three times, similar to the morning washing. Go off to the bathroom. Make sure that you do that. Why? Because we are preparing ourselves, preparing our hands for all the things of holiness, of our involvement in activities of good stuff, kedusha, holiness, that is going to follow thereafter. So, great role that water plays in our life, great role that washing of the hands plays in our Jewish liturgy and in our activities, and hope that shed some light and some insight into the various different times of hand washing that actually needs to take place from a Jewish point of view. It doesn't and shouldn't become something that's obsessive, but if we just focus on doing it at these times and making sure that we have that mindset of what am I doing this for? It's not a cleanliness thing. This is rather something of I need to make sure at all times that I have clean hands. When we have clean hands from a spiritual point of view, we're going to be able to function much better as Jews. We're going to be able to do what we need to do properly and well. And we can view ourselves as those Kohanim coming into the temple, of our day, of our afternoon, of our evening, of whatever it is that we're engaged in, and making sure that we do it with the necessary feeling of kedusha, of holiness, bringing godliness into the world, because is that not what we as Jews are truly all about and what we are beckoned to do? It's been great being with you. It's always wonderful to be able to share some time with you. And we now come towards the end of our time together, so it remains for me to wish you a great rest of the week, a great Shabbat, Shabbos up ahead, a great month of Adar that we are now well and truly into, and look forward to being back with you same time, same place next week for another exciting episode of Judaism 101.9.